I am very grateful to be with all of you this evening. My special gratitude to Baba Sahib Purandare for taking so much trouble out of his great kindness to be with us this evening. Thank you very much, Maharaj. And my gratitude to all of you for taking your precious time for this event. One of the most difficult things of my life was to write this book, The Journey Home. For about 40 years, people have been requesting me to do this, but I always resisted, thinking it's very uncomfortable to write a book about myself. But about 5 years ago, one of my dearest friends, Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj, a very enlightened spiritual person, he called me to his bedside as he was dying of cancer. I spent 7 weeks there with him. And one day, he clasped my hand and he said, "You must write this book." I told him my reservations. Isn't it an act of arrogance to write a whole book about me? He said, "This book is not about you. This is a story of how God led a young boy on a spiritual journey in search of the truths that lie within the heart of every living being. If this story will help people in their lives, then it is arrogance for you not to write it. Promise me on my deathbed that you will write this book." I promised him, and a few days later he passed away from this world. The title, The Journey Home, means the home that is with our home is not of this world. Everything is changing. Everything will be destroyed and taken away by the power of time. But within the heart is the Atma, the soul. And that soul is part of God. Krishna tells in Gita, "Aham Bija Prata Pita." I am the seed-giving father and mother of every living being. Our real home is in reuniting with our ultimate object of love, Krishna, within the heart. And everyone is searching there. I was born in 1950 in Chicago, and was raised in a suburb north of Chicago, where material comforts and prosperity were something very ordinary. And I saw around me people struggling to accumulate more and more and more of these things, and trying to find more and more pleasure through the senses and the mind. But there was no real fulfillment. I saw so much hypocrisy. At that time, there was a Vietnam War, a war where we had to go and fight for something we didn't believe in. It was a time when people were persecuted and beaten down because of the color of their skin. And this is considered a land of freedom? Many questions burned in my mind. I tried to find solutions through political activism. But in my own mind, I saw the same type of problems among the people who were politically active as the people they were active against. What was the real solution? I heard from the Reverend Martin Luther King a statement that really hit me hard in the heart. He said, if you do not have something, an ideal, if you do not have an ideal you are willing to die for, then you have nothing really meaningful to live for. I needed to find that ideal in my life. When I was 19, a friend of mine named Gary, who I grew up with from small childhood, we decided to see how other people in other parts of the world viewed life, values, and God. So we decided to take a 3-month holiday to Europe. We had no money, but we had a friend who had money, and he promised he would pay our way and everything else. We arrived in Luxembourg, a small country in Europe, and the first day our friend was robbed. He had nothing. He said, I'm going home, you should come with me. How could we survive with nothing? But Gary and I stayed. And I remember that day sitting on the bank of a small river, watching the current of the water, and thinking, where will the current of destiny lead me? I had to find my destiny. So we hitchhiked around Europe, and more there was this calling in my heart. It was a calling to seek spiritual truth. It began like a little spark. And I was going to synagogues, cathedrals, monasteries, going to museums, studying religious art, trying to find symbolism. It was burning hotter and hotter, until this spiritual search was the only thing I was living for. Eventually, Gary and I were on an island of Greece, living in a cave. And every day, I would climb a mountain. From sunrise to sunset, I would meditate, pray, and study religious books. One day, as the sun was setting, I was weeping and crying for direction. And something happened that changed my life forever. I heard 3 words from within my heart that I believed were the words of God. Those 3 words, go to India. I climbed back down to the cave where Gary was in meditation. I said, Gary, something very, very extraordinary happened to me today. He said, something amazing happened to me. I said, what? He said, at sunset, I heard a voice. You did? What did he say? Gary said, you won't believe me. I said, I might. Said, this voice told me, go to Israel. What? Where? He told me to go to India. By that time it was dark, and I looked over at the sky, over the Mediterranean Sea, into the stars, and I whispered to God, "Yes, I am willing," and told Gary, "At sunrise tomorrow, I'm going to India." He was very alarmed. "You have no money. You're all alone. How will you get there? The Middle East is very dangerous." I told him I believe that if I just keep hitchhiking in the eastern direction, someday I will arrive at the land of my dreams. And I left. It was the hardest time of my life, traveling through Turkey, where people tried to kill me, traveling through Iran, where I studied Islam under a scholar and a practitioner, through Afghanistan, where every place I went, life-changing experiences came upon me. Then I went through Pakistan. It took me 6 months from London until I came to the border of India. Going through that no man's land between Pakistan and India, my heart was beating with anticipation. I will soon reach the land of my dreams. Soon I will be going to those Himalayan hermitages to meet the sages, the yogis, the rishis, the lamas that I've read about so much, and learn about the great wealth of spiritual tradition of India. I was so close. I came to the immigration table and gave a lady my passport and visa. She looked, then stared in my eyes and asked, "Show me your money." I reached in my bag and found 31 cents. She said, "That's all you have?" I said, "That's all I have." "You need at least $200 to enter India. Show me $200 or go home. You are rejected." I begged, I pleaded, but the more I pleaded, the more she became angry at me and shouted, "Get out from here. You will not come into India. We have enough beggars. We don't want another one." Where could I go? I couldn't go back into Pakistan, because I only had a one-time visa there, and I couldn't go to India, so I was stuck between two enemy countries. I sat under a neem tree in that no man's land. I was only 19 years old, praying to God, "You brought me this far, will you not let me in?" I went back again and again and again, and every time she rejected me. At one point, she was so angry, she had the security forces point their rifles in my face and force me to go back. I sat there for 6 hours. Then there was a change in guard, and a Sikh gentleman was told by the lady, "Don't let him in," and she drove off in a jeep. When she was out of sight, I went to the new immigration agent, and he looked at me very sternly and said, "I have been ordered by my superior to reject you. Show me money or go home." I began to cry. It wasn't a stage crying. It was for real. I pleaded, give me a chance. I've hitchhiked and risked my life and caught all sorts of horrible diseases trying to come to your land, to see your culture, to meet your people, to meet the saintly people that you have. Someday, I promise you, I'll try to do something good for your people. Just give me a chance. He looked for a long time in my eyes and said, "Sometimes a man must follow his heart. I have been ordered by my superior to reject you, but I'm going to let you in." And he stamped my passport and put his hand on my head. And I'll never forget the words he said to me. He said, "Son, may you find what you are crying for. Welcome to India." By that time it was night, and it was the Ferozpur border in Punjab, and I was walking through some agricultural fields. It was just a countryside. I didn't know which direction to walk. I was just walking through fields. I never met a person from India in my whole life. I knew no one there. I had no money. I had no map. I was just walking. But something mystical happened. For the first time in my life, I felt at home. I felt like I was being embraced by my own mother. And I was thanking every leaf on every tree and thanking every star in the sky. I was so grateful. Just 2 months ago, I had the fortune of meeting with the President of India. Ms. Pratibha Patil. She invited me to offer this same book, The Journey Home, to her. When I came to the security forces outside the presidential palace, the top security guards of India were guarding. And they asked my name, and I said, "Radhanath Swami," and they said, "Oh, we are expecting you." And they offered pranams and welcomed me. And then when their secure personal security guards were taking me through those magnificent corridors of the presidential palace, I was looking up and seeing in gold leaf the verses from Bhagavad Gita. And I've been to the White House in America. And although I was born in America, I must honestly say that the President's Palace in India is much nicer. So much culture, so much art, so much feeling. And as I was walking through those corridors, and I came into the room where the President, Ms. Patil, with folded hands, greeted me and offered me a basket of fresh fruits. I was thinking how exactly 40 years before, how different things were for me. How there were guns pointed at my face to chase me away. I told this story to my father. My father said, "This is the story of rags to riches." I said, it's not really a story of rags to riches because I'm still wearing rags and I still have no money. So there's no riches. But then I was thinking, maybe he's right. Because in the culture of India, in the heritage of this Vedic civilization, through the people of India, I have gained the greatest wealth, the greatest riches of my life, the riches of Dharma, the riches of truth, the riches of a spiritual ideal that I could live for and die for with great happiness. President Patil asked me, and she's a brilliant woman, she asked, coming from a wealthy country like America, why do you choose to live in India? And having studied Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, and so many religions, why did you dedicate your life to being a Hindu? I tried to give her a brief answer, but she probed deeper and deeper and deeper. Should I tell you, in essence, what I shared with her? Other religions of the world, I believe, and I experienced it, because I was following all these different religions, searching for truth. And I found that the essence of all these great spiritual paths is the same. To love God, to have good character, to be a humble, compassionate instrument of God's love in everything and anything we do in our life. I told her what I learned is it's not about being a Hindu or a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian or a Parsi or a Jain or anything else. Real spirituality is about awakening the love of God that is within our hearts and being a compassionate human being in the service of God. In other religions of the world, I found that there's a book with a single historical revelation of a particular avatar or prophet. And oftentimes that leads to a sectarian idea. This is the truth and there is no other truth. And religion, instead of bringing openness and love, it brings sectarian and hatred and ego. Because they're trying to understand the form, but not the substance and essence within that form. But in the Vedas, there's stories of many, many avatars, many revelations. There is Narasimha, there is Varaha, there is Shiva, there is Ram, there is Krishna. Many saints, many prophets, many avatars, spanning over millions and millions of years. The teachings of the Vedas are so broad, so inclusive, but not in just a sentimental way, but in a deeply logical, philosophical, scientific way, that I could see through the eyes of Vedic knowledge, what really is the essence and the common theme in all religions. And in this Hindu faith, the inclusiveness, the thoroughness, and the greatness of the sages and the seers and the rishis who embody this. I told her, in this world where there's so much factionalization, there needs to be this holistic view, which the Vedic culture so perfectly presents for the whole world. and how much pain I was seeing. She asked me, what is the difference between India today and the India 40 years ago when you first came? Explained to her, one of the greatest tragedies of this world is that the youth of India is not recognizing the greatness of their own culture, a greatness that the world desperately needs to understand. Giving up this rare diamond of truth and knowledge to chase after the broken pieces of glass of American and European prosperity. But what kind of prosperity? Science, technology, and all of these things are only so good as they are utilized by people with character who believe and are willing to live and die for Dharma. Losing this. 800 years of the Mughal Empire, 200 years of the British Empire, but the spirit of Dharma was still so live and strong in India. But Western television, Western products and entertainment styles, are fastly distracting the youth's mind away from the wealth that we have. She seemed quite happy with my answers. From that border in Punjab, I traveled to the Himalayas. My first day in the bank of the Ganges, one sadhu approached me. He saw me meditating on the riverbank in Rishikesh. And he said, I believe that you are sincere. Take off your Western clothes and throw them in the Ganges River. And I will award you the robes of a sadhu. I only had one set of clothes. I took off my jeans and my shirt and threw them in Ganga. And he gave me two pieces of cloth and told me how to wrap it around my body. I asked him, what is a sadhu? He said, a sadhu is one who wanders the world seeking spiritual truth. And then he said something that was profound. He said, Ganga will become your mother. This will be revealed in time. And then he left. I never saw him again. I sat in a rock inside the Ganges for 1 month. One person would give me one carrot every day as I was walking back to the cave in the jungle that I was living in. And I can tell you honestly, I went to American high schools and colleges, but I never learned so much in life as sitting on the bank of the Ganga, just hearing her song and hearing her wisdom. Ganga Devi has three features. She's a body of water where we can bathe, drink water, cook with. She irrigates crops. Ganga is also a place of pilgrimage. that removes our sins and gives us piety. But Ganga is also a goddess, the divine feminine potency of Bhagavan, of God. And when we open our heart with love to Ganga, she reveals herself to us. And the deepest mysteries of love and compassion. I watched as the flow of the Ganga never stopped her journey to the sea. She flowed around rocks and trees and mountains. And I believe that she was teaching me that if we want to reach the sea of our aspiration in life, we have to have this determination of Mother Ganga and never stop trying. No matter what obstacles, no matter what impediments, however difficult they may seem, we must flow over, under, or around. But we must never stop until we reach the sea of our goal. And with the help of God, we will reach the sea. Many lessons. I met with Jai Krishnamurti, Swami Rama, Swami Satchidananda. I lived in the ashram of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. I lived with Swami Chidananda Saraswati of the Shivananda Ashram. I lived with a cave-dwelling saint named Tatwalababa in the jungles. I learned many lessons in a leprosy colony. I was hungry, and it's amazing when you're hungry to learn. Every situation is orchestrated by God to teach you lessons. Krishna says in Gita, Ye yatham prapadyante tam stataiva bhajamya mama vartmanu paratante manushya parata sarvasha. If we approach God, the Lord reciprocates. If we're looking for truth, Krishna will reveal truth in every situation. If we're looking for some selfish desire, Krishna will reveal ways to fulfill our selfish desires. Everything is based in our desire. I met one Kailash Baba. He was living in the jungles of the Himalayas. He taught me how to learn Dharma from the snakes, from the leopards, from the insects and the mosquitoes, from the trees. He taught me how to find food that is edible in herbs and leaves. He taught me how to beg with integrity. He taught me how to mix with other sadhus of different sampradayas. And the amazing thing, I learned so much from him, but he did not speak one word of English, and I did not speak Hindi, except Hindi ne janta. But just through the hearts, he taught me so much. Just by a glance, or pointing his finger, or nodding his head. Wisdom is something that is of the heart. It's not just something of language. Language can present it, but the heart can also do so. I lived in the ashram of Anandamayi Ma, who I had read about in Autobiography of a Yogi. In my travels, I lived with Dalai Lama of Tibet, Mother Teresa in Calcutta. I live with S.N. Goenkaji, a Buddhist meditation teacher in Bodh Gaya. Many, many people. At one point, I was in Bodhinath. This story our Gauranga Prabhu requested that I tell. I was in this countryside in Kathmandu Valley, sitting under a tree meditating, watching the rainbow in the monsoon sky. And there I heard these foot stomping. And there was a huge European man with gigantic muscles on his body. He must have been about 6'5". He was a bodybuilder. He was carrying a huge bag of groceries. And he looked really proud. But then a pack of brown monkeys surrounded him. They were very small compared to him, but they showed their teeth and they started screeching very loudly and gazing upon him with such vicious eyes. So he picked up a rock and screamed and waved it, and they just started jumping toward him. And I saw right before my eyes this man. He was so overcome with fear that he stood there trembling as one little skinny monkey grabbed the whole grocery bag from his hand and took it away. Then the monkeys all started jumping into the grocery bag, eating things, and he ran away. A few seconds later, there was a little Nepalese boy, skinny little boy, about 8 years old. He had a little stone in his hand, and he came running toward the monkeys, and they all screeched in fear and ran away. And he sat there and started eating the groceries, and the monkeys were looking from a distance, afraid to go near him. And I was thinking, what did I just see? This boy was less weight than that European's one arm. Why are they afraid of him but not afraid of the big person? And then I understood. Fear. Because the monkeys, they were looking for the weakness in him, and his weakness was fear. We fear what we do not understand. And that was one of our greatest weaknesses. But the little boy, he lived with monkeys all his life. He had absolutely no fear of them. And because he had no fear, they were afraid of him. There's a saying, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. We fear what we do not know. In the whole world, people are afraid of death. Why? Because we don't know what's going to happen after death. Where Krishna tells in Gita, na jayate mriyate vaka dachin, for the soul, there is no death, there is no birth, we are eternal. All fear is due to our misconception that I'm this body, I'm this mind, forgetfulness of our immortal, indestructible soul as part of God. And there can't be any real peace and happiness in this world unless we realize that fearless state within ourselves. And it is within each and every one of us. It's what the Gita and every great spiritual teacher has been telling us. You are a part of God. And when we recognize the part of God that is within us, we can also recognize that same part of God in every living being. I was walking through an expansive rice paddy field. And suddenly, dark clouds formed in the sky. And I understood there was about to be a major monsoon rainstorm. I was looking for shelter, because I only had my one set of sadhu clothes that person gave me. And as I was walking, I was looking for a tree or something to take shelter under, but there was nothing. It was just a rice paddy. And then I saw a distance away what appeared to be a little old man walking with an umbrella. And I thought, I have to walk under that umbrella with him. Now, you know, the rice paddies, there's just a very small border that you could walk on above all the mud and the water. And it's only big enough for one person. So I was running very fast. I was 20 years old at the time. And I finally reached this person, and it started raining very hard, and I, right behind him, I walked under his umbrella. About 10 minutes, we walked together. He never looked back to see who I was. I guess he was afraid of slipping in the mud. And then the rain stopped. And I realized I was going the wrong direction. So I thanked him. And he turned around. He was shocked. He dropped his umbrella right in the mud. And I was more shocked than him. It was my friend Gary. We hadn't seen each other for 1 year since we left on that island in Greece. But by the will of God, we were brought together, the only two people in a vast rice paddy in Nepal, walking under an umbrella for 10 minutes without recognizing each other. Then he took me to where he was staying, with friends who were playing Western music and doing so many other things. And I said, Gary, you're in India. This is the land of Dharma. This is the land of sadhus. This is the land of spiritual culture. While you're here, become a sadhu, and I'll teach you, and I'll bring you to people who can give you wisdom and spiritual wealth like you've never seen before. And he came. But after some time, we were mysteriously separated from each other again. I came to Bombay, Mumbai, and I was walking down the streets barefoot, after living in Nityananda Baba's Samadhi Mandir in Brajeshwari and Ganeshpuri and meeting his disciple Swami Muktananda. I was just walking through the streets of Bombay and I saw a big sign advertising a spiritual festival. So I came in there. This is a long story, but I'm making it very short. And that evening, there was about 20,000 people gathered in a massive pandal tent to hear A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada speak. I was way in the back, and I could hardly see him. But I was praying to God, I wish, he's another great sage of India, I wish I could get closer. And then I saw Prabhupada whisper something in one of his disciples' ears, and that disciple started signaling for someone to come on stage. And ultimately, he came through the massive crowd and walked right up to me and took me by the hand and said, my Gurudev wants you to sit on the stage with him. I asked, how does he know me? He didn't answer. But he brought me on the stage and Prabhupada welcomed me. I felt very out of place. I was accustomed to living in caves and jungles or on riverbanks, and here I was on a stage with 20,000 people looking at me as I was sitting with a few disciples. He showed great compassion to me. But then I left on my journey. And many months later, I found myself in Vrindavan. I was going to Amarnath for a pilgrimage on a third-class train. The train was very crowded and very hot. It was a third-class and no ticket collectors could get in because it was too crowded. This was the way sadhus traveled back then, free of cost. The price was not in rupees, but there was a price. And the train stopped and I needed water and I needed air, so I climbed out of a window. And then when the train started moving, it was a steam engine, I couldn't get back in. It was too crowded. I was stranded. It was about 5 in the morning, and I asked someone on the railway platform, "Where am I?" He said, "This is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace, and today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday." Some sadhus took me to the Janmasthan, and I decided to leave 3 days later for Amarnath. But on the third day, I was sleeping on the bank of the Jamuna River, and I couldn't move. I had typhoid fever. I was dying of fever. And by the time I got well, Vrindavan enchanted my heart. Everything I was looking for, I found in the beautiful path of bhakti, or love for Krishna. The philosophy, the teachings, the feelings of every religion I studied were there, but there was something so much more, so intimate, so sweet, so beautiful in the love of the Brijavasis and in the grace of Krishna. And it was there that I met Srila Prabhupada again. And it's a long story, but I decided that I want to assist him in his compassionate mission to present the infinitely rich Vedic culture in such a practical and such a convincing way for people all over India and all over the world. And again in 1986, I made my base in Mumbai, in this great state of Maharashtra, where I have been from my heart of hearts, trying to fulfill my promise to that custom agent that I would try to do something good for the people of India. But I could never repay the country or the people of Bharatvarsha. But I'm very honored to have the opportunity to try. This is the subject of this book, The Journey Home.
Thank you very much.